everyone. I just wanted to jump in and say that I know it's been a while since I've posted a podcast. The family went through COVID, so it's been a little rough, but I'm slowly getting over it. As you know, someone with a chronic illness, sometimes getting sick will then create a flare-up, so I think that's what I'm going through right now. So I want to go ahead and get this up. I would have loved to have done a little bit more with it, because I think at the time I recorded it, I was starting to feel bad, and I think I covered as much as I wanted to, but it is a very intense topic, so I'll be getting another one out as soon as I can. Also, in the actual body of this podcast, I mentioned that I might be changing platforms for hosting the podcast. I have decided to go ahead and do that because the service I use charges a fee. It's a small fee, but you know, it's something that I can't keep paying. So I'll keep the current service for the next week or so. Right now it's December 13th, so I'll go ahead and just keep that for about a week, and then I'll move it move it to the new platform. All right. Thank you so much for your patience. Bye. I guess I shouldn't say bye. The podcast is now upcoming.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to See the Invisible, Living with an Invisible or Rare Disease. My name is Rhonda Franny Jefferson, and thank you so much for joining me today. If you're new here, just to tell you a little bit about myself and the podcast, I just hope to, you know, spread an understanding and some positivity, especially for those who, you know, do have an invisible illness, or if you're a caregiver or relative of someone with an invisible illness, that there is support out there, that even though someone may not be in the exact same situation, there are people who understand what you're going through. So I started this podcast as a way to, you know, try to let other people know, okay, you're not alone, because especially during the pandemic, I was feeling alone, had a lot of negative feedback. So, I just felt that if I was getting some of that negative feedback, others may have been as well. So here we are. Now, before we get too much further into the episode, I do just want to let everybody know that within the next one or two episodes, probably, I will be moving to a different podcast host. Right now, I pay every month for the podcast hosting. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not an extreme amount every month, but, you know, it's enough that, you know, after a number of months, I've considered moving things, and there is another host, that I can, you know, probably use for actually no charge. So, I'll update the Facebook page if I do change that. But again, it should be within the next one or two episodes. Also, before we start into the topics, I'm going to give my normal disclaimer that I am in no way a medical, legal, or insurance expert. That if you do have any questions within those fields, that you do, you know, make sure that you reach out to the appropriate person. You know, I just want to make sure everybody's getting the best and correct information that you can get. My podcast is not meant to in any way be, you know, medical advice. I'm just hoping to share my experiences, my ideas and thoughts regarding different topics that those with certain types of illnesses have to face every day. Now, we have been going through healthcare disparities. And on the last episode, I did also explain, I found out there's a difference between disparities and inequities. And so where a lot of people do use the term disparity, it's probably more apt to call it an inequity, where disparities are things that, you know, necessarily cannot be avoided, such as, if you take an illness that someone who is 80 years old has and someone who's 20 years old has the same illness, there is, of course, going to be some disparity in how they may react to certain things on average, because age is a factor in there that cannot be, you know, changed in regards to these patients. So in regards to inequities, though, these are things that can be systemic things that, you know, we can look at, review, and try to find ways to, you know, just erase those inequities that appear within the healthcare system. So this week, I wanted to start looking at the actual subcategories, I guess you would say, of inequities. You know, there are so many places that there can be inequities. Gender, race, sexual identity, cultural beliefs, and the list can go on and on and on. So it's, you know, there's just so many factors that can play a role in healthcare treatment. And the goal is to get to the point where those things that cannot be changed, those things that can be changed, where there are inequities, that we go ahead and address them and make sure that those are minimized to the point that they are non-existent. And part of that is, of course, first understanding where those inequities lie. So, you know, there's unfortunately biases. And a lot of times I really feel the biases aren't even known. And also there's a matter of perspective. So what I mean by that is the doctor may not even realize that they're engaging in a bias to their patient where they actually are. And then also within, you know, say that same action, two different patients may see it in two different ways. And there is actually a study that shows that, which I found to be very interesting. And, you know, the first area of bias that we're going to look at is the socioeconomic biases. So, you know, with the socioeconomic, a lot of times doctors see it first in, you know, what type of insurance do you have? Is it state or like a Medicaid or Medicare, or is it private insurance? So, you know, some of the perceptions have changed too with the increase in, you know, people being able to get coverage through the Affordable Care Act. But as I've mentioned in my previous episodes as well, that it used to be a time where those disparities and inequities would sometimes present themselves as either you have private insurance or you don't have private insurance or you have no insurance, like those areas. But that's kind of been expanded with the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, I'm going to give an example that's not socioeconomic, but this will give an idea of perception. And, you know, that idea might help us, you know, kind of move forward and help understand what doctors are seeing, what we're seeing, what nurses can be seeing. And, you know, I have discussed my own experiences, and through these next few episodes especially, I may be discussing them a little bit more than usual. So I've kind of been all over the place. I've not had insurance for a while. I've had Medicaid at points in time. And probably for the vast majority of my life, I've had private insurance through my job. Now, the thing is, within that private insurance, more so now than probably 30 or 40 years ago, but that private insurance now has this vast range of either it's really, really good, or you have these really high copays and deductibles and coinsurance. So, you know, whereas it used to be, okay, well, you have insurance, that's good, it's not quite the same as it is now. So even times where, like the insurance that I've had in the past compared to when I was on Medicaid, Medicaid covered everything for me. Whereas, you know, with one of the other insurances, I had a really high deductible, and, you know, it was just really more than, you know, I could really afford it most times. And then there was another insurance I had through my work that covered everything. So there's no way that doctors really can look at, okay, well, they have this type of insurance or that, and understand what the individual's needs are. You know, it someone, you know, may have their own insurance through work, but that deductible may be extremely high and they may not be able to do certain testing or procedures, but the doctor doesn't have a good understanding of that and can make assumptions, which we will actually be going through a couple of examples a little bit later. Now, just the example of myself that I want to put out there is that I am overweight. That is, you know, not disputed in any way, but I also have lymphedema. And in simple terms, that's like swelling, but there's different degrees of it. And mine is pretty severe. There was a time where, you know, I was in the hospital and they actually wrapped my legs up while I was under sedation because they said it would hurt so bad to try to force fluid out. And then, you know, they gave me diuretics to help force the fluid out. The problem is, as soon as I'm off those diuretics by IV and I'm not having my legs continuously wrapped, that weight by water can come right back on. It should be pretty obvious by looking at my legs, I have lymphedema. So at any given time, there can be an additional 50 pounds or more of weight on me due to fluid. And there was, at the most severe instance when they got the fluid off of me, it was over 100 pounds. So after that point, I literally could get my waist into the leg of the pants that I was wearing because I had to have my pants custom made. So that's how big my legs were. The proportions of the legs do look different with lymphedema. So that's what I mean by it should be fairly obvious that I have that. Now, I also had to take steroids for a very long time for my autoinflammatory illness. And because this disease is rare, there was no FDA-approved treatment for decades after this, you know, first, this disease was first diagnosed and accepted. So it was for about the first 8 years of my diagnosis that I wasn't able to get approval for some of the medication, and I was on steroids, which you're not supposed to be on them that long, but it was necessary because it was really the only option I had. But steroids can, of course, cause weight gain. They can even cause my swelling to get worse. So that was kind of a kick to the gut, so to say, that, you know, here I have this one illness, I have this other condition, and the medication that I need to take to literally keep the inflammation down from around my organs, from things that, you know, could impact my health in a more detrimental way, I had to take it, but it was also causing me issues. So unless the doctor really takes some time to talk to me and understand why certain things are happening, the first thing that a lot of them may think is, oh, she's fat and lazy. the worst case that I've ever had is, oh, and I'm sorry, the lymphedema puts me more at risk for a certain type of infection called cellulitis, but the medication I'm on for my autoinflammatory illness decreases my immune system. So again, it's kind of, you know, they're impacting each other. So once I start to get that infection, if I notice it coming on, I have to get help immediately. It's not like I can necessarily wait for my doctor's office to open. If I go to the immediate care clinic, they actually will send me to the hospital, and they've done that twice. I was hoping not to have to go to the hospital once, but they said, no, you have to go. So, you know, it's something that I cannot just say I'm going to wait. One time I did wait 24 hours, and I ended up being in the hospital for over a week and missing two or three more weeks of work. So it has to be taken care of. I went to the ER one evening, and I was waiting. It hadn't been incredibly long, but a doctor walked in and started to say something, and he looked down and saw that I wasn't in a gown. Well, the nurse had never given me a gown, so he yells at the nurse and then grabs a gown out of the cupboard and throws it down on me and tells the nurse that he didn't have time for me today. Now, I'd never seen this doctor before, or actually he was a physician's assistant, but I may still keep referring him to the doctor as a doctor because in my mind, in the ER, that's really what he was. He hadn't looked at my chart. He had done nothing because, according to what he told me later, he was about 30 minutes late for his work shift because he didn't take traffic into account. You know, so apparently that was my fault, so he didn't have time for me. But I don't know the reason for him judging me the way he did, but of course my mind immediately goes to my weight because I've experienced that in the past. And I did start to cry, and there was a nurse who was trying to comfort me and talk to me. And when he walks in and sees me crying, it just devolved into this shouting match because he got so mad at me for crying. And when I told him what was wrong, you know, I told him I felt it was because he was judging me because of my weight. It just was this shouting match. And I mean, at one point when I said, well, you just threw a gown at me and then you walked away for an hour, he actually went back and checked the notes on his on the computer, as well as the time that he clocked in and when he was seeing me then, and said, no, it was not an hour, it was 58 minutes. So that was kind of the attitude of the physician's assistant that I was dealing with. And at some point during that, he turns to one of the nurses and says, just give her what she wants, and walks out. So I told the nurse what I normally get to treat this, and he wrote it up for the doctor. The doctor signed it, and that was it. So, and he still got paid, you know, because of course he submits the full bill, even though he literally did nothing yet except make me feel like I was garbage. So, I've also experienced some issues due to insurance coverage, and doctors are limited to some extent of what insurance will cover. But some doctors don't even try to submit things to insurance. I've had issues where I should have been admitted. My primary care doctor called to the hospital and said she needs to be admitted, but the hospital would not admit me because they said they didn't think that insurance would cover it. They didn't even try. But you know, even in the most mundane tasks that doctors perform, there can be biases, such as explaining a diagnosis to a patient. And this is, I think, one of the biggest invisible biases that medical professionals may have. And, you know, again, I don't believe that they're necessarily trying to sound one way or the other. They're just explaining something the way they normally do to someone, but everybody is different. And, you know, somebody who may be a scientist, you know, work in the sciences, may have a better understanding than someone who works in, let's just say, a field that requires a lot of writing. You know, there are different lengths as far as what people know and different strengths. So you can't necessarily always just explain something to every person the same way. Maybe a way to think of it is, you know, you may have heard that there's different types of learning, such as visual, auditory. Sometimes a lot of people like to be hands-on. So there's just different ways that people learn. And so as you can't approach each student or person the same way to teach them something, a doctor can't approach explanations as a one-size-fits-all category. So, at the same time, you don't want the doctor to talk to you like, you know, they're talking down to you. So there's kind of a fine line as to, you know, what is, you know, acceptable for each patient. And we, you know, need to realize as patients that we have the right to ask questions, that we have a right to be engaged in, the explanation of the diagnosis, and that, you know, we shouldn't leave that explanation not understanding what's happening. Now, I know that sometimes if you have questions, they're not going to immediately come to your mind, especially if you have a diagnosis that's, you know, a surprise. But, you know, make sure you have that open line of communication with the doctor so that you can follow up and, you know, get the explanations that you need. Now, getting a little bit more into the socioeconomic part of things, some terms or ideas to remember about these biases is they're implicit and they're pervasive. In other words, they kind of run across the whole gamut of things. And a lot of times they are unaware of the biases, but those biases actually impact their behavior. And you know, each doctor, though, may have different levels of bias. And, you know, one doctor may have a bias in one field but not another. And then the next doctor may be the exact opposite. So things that really are looked at in these socioeconomic factors are a difference in treatment and in decision making. This can sometimes lead to the actual patient not really feeling like they're the most important part of the treatment, when of course they are. It's just if a patient is made to feel like the whole basis of the treatment is only what insurance will cover, and that's said at the very beginning, it makes someone feel like, okay, well, what am I then? I'm just the insurance ID number? Is that it? You know, it really takes that personal touch away from the patient. And, you know, the doctor needs to be able to communicate this adequately as far as, yes, there may be limitations, but this is what I'm going to do. That the doctor has a willingness to try, that they have an understanding, but at the same time, they're looking at you as an individual, and they're not just saying, well, you know what, insurance doesn't normally cover this, and then just kind of swiping it away and not thinking about it again. The doctor should be open. They shouldn't seem reserved, be far back, like standing really far back from you. They should be engaged as far as focusing their eyes, their speech on you and not things that are going on around. You know, they're, and also kind of my pet peeve is not to seem rushed. Now, I'm just going to give an example of the best doctor that I think there is on earth. And unfortunately, I only had him for about a year when I had moved to a different part of the state. Now, he would not allow patients to be scheduled any closer than 30 minutes apart. Whereas a lot of offices you see like 10 or 15 minute blocks or maybe even less. He had his own office. It was his practice. And there was a 30-minute time frame between each patient. The two reasons for that were, and actually three if you look at one of those reasons separately. One is so he could spend a lot of time with each patient. And the second part to that was so he could notate the account while everything was fresh in his mind. Not, you know, like 20 minutes later coming back and saying, okay, you know, I need to put this in. He was doing it immediately, so if there were any questions, everything was there. The other part to it was also, if he did happen to have an extra patient or two that needed to be seen immediately, there was then that leeway to try to fit that patient in. Now, he did let his patients know at one point he was actually, you know, leaving his practice. He had brought in like a nurse practitioner at some point, and I'm not sure if she took over or how that worked, but he was leaving to actually work for a clinic that worked with people who you maybe didn't have insurance or who had high deductibles. And basically it was, I don't want to say pro bono, but it really wasn't profit driven. It was patient driven, which is, you know, what all medical procedures to me should be. Now, just before I get into these next numbers of this study, you know, I've been an advocate of making sure that research numbers are up to date. You know, even now, some of the numbers that I'm going to be reading from are from years ago. Part of that is for a very valid reason, but in other instances, it's not so valid. But without having research numbers up to date, how is somebody supposed to address those issues? Now, in this particular study, the reason why I say dates are kind of important is it was studied the last year before the Affordable Care Act was implemented, and then in the first year that it was implemented. So it was a relatively small study just done at one hospital clinic, but in some ways that was very important to do because it looked at the perceptions of patients, and that way the studies were looking at the same doctors. So to understand those differences, there needed to be, you know, kind of a cross-section of different patients that worked with the same doctors. Otherwise, there was no way to really set a baseline for each doctor. So even though it was small, and again, in some ways it was kind of necessary as the same doctors needed to be worked with over time. Now, the years that these took place were 2013 and 14. And they looked at the 2013 numbers, and I'm going to quote here. In 2013, all scheduled patients from a clinic devoted to patients enrolled in state Medicaid program financed through a 1115 waiver from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So that's how they looked at participants in 2013. The percentages of the patients here, about 90% of the enrollees of the Medicaid program in this particular area were living at 100% or lower than the federal poverty level. Now, where the 100% comes into account is, let's just say someone was applying for some type of state or federal assistance. There is a poverty level that the government determines. And if you're at 100% or lower, that means you're actually making less than what that poverty level is. Now, some assistance programs say you have to be lower than 200% of the poverty level or 300%. And what that does is, you know, it might say, okay, you're living above the poverty level, but, you know, it's, you still will probably need assistance, so we're going to prorate that for you or things like that. So in this particular study, again, 90% of the enrollees were living below that 100%. And the statewide poverty rate was 12.8. So this was, you know, a good portion of the patients in this study when it was at 90%. Now, in 2014, there was an expansion of Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act. Unfortunately, that only lasted 1 year, but it really did help the patients. So in 2014, what they looked at was also the study included those who had this type of insurance, and it increased the patient's ability to see different primary care providers through the state, you know, whereas when it's Medicaid or Medicare, not every doctor actually accepts that. So having that ability to have different primary care doctors, it kind of opened up the ability for patients to have more choices. So the way they determine these factors, because perceptions are not a solid number, it's not like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or a percentage. It really is nuanced and subjective. So all of the interviews were done by one person. That way there was not like another factor in there. It was one person who was trained in certain interviewing techniques. So, you know, there were kind of open-ended questions to the patients, such as asking how they felt their healthcare experience was, and then this research assistant would then break it down into, you know, more detail to get an idea. Now, previously, a lot of the studies were done from the perspective of the doctor or the medical professional. So this was new in, you know, the fact that it was looking at the actual patients. And through the research gathered in the interviews, there seemed to be three main areas of how patients thought their socioeconomic status impacted their care. And it was the actual treatment that was provided to them, their access to care, which, if you listened to previous episodes, you know is a big thing for me, and patient-provider interaction. So that's more of, you know, the one-on-one, the discussions and things like that. Now, looking then at the first one was the impact of the treatment provided. And this is something I found really, really interesting that we'll see in a minute or two. So, you know, a lot of the people who were interviewed thought that they could not get certain types of testing done because they didn't think that they had the insurance that would cover it. You know, they basically had this assumption that because they were either on Medicaid or through some type of state-funded insurance, that they just could not get the testing that was needed because it would not cover it because of a high cost. It may or may not have been true. You know, you don't know if the testing that would have been approved, because in a lot of cases, it was not even offered as an option. So again, this is where the doctor just assumed and didn't even try. You know, they also then were under the impression that even if the doctor did try, that it could take longer to get an approval for that test than for than for other testing. So another thing that the patients who saw the impact within their treatment, they looked at medications. And you know, generic medication is actually, you know, very cost effective, and in many, many cases, it works just the same as if you were taking the name brand. But, you know, occasionally there is a medicine, you know, that someone might need that, you know, could actually, you know, you have to have the actual name brand. So a lot of the patients just figured they couldn't get the name brand, even if they thought it might be more effective, because they had the impression through the healthcare provider that it would not be covered. So, you know, again, they just figured it was part of the limitations they had. Now, on the other hand, and this is where I find the information interesting, there were other patients who actually appreciated this. Some patients felt that, you know, doctors overall ordered too many tests, which, you know, took a lot of time out for the patients, you know, from things that they had to do. You know, if they were working, they would have to take time off work, things like that. As well as, you know, I can say from experience that testing can cause some stress. You're sitting there waiting to get the results back of each test. So a lot of patients did actually find that they preferred the doctors not trying to get what they called unnecessary testing done. And they appreciated the fact that they weren't being prescribed more expensive medication. So I can actually see both sides. Now, I know that different Medicaid programs may work differently from state to state, but I know that when I was on it and my illness had not been diagnosed yet with a name, but I knew that there was something wrong. I mean, you know, I was seeing so many different specialists and no one ever quite put the facts together. You know, the fact that I was seeing this specialist, this one, you know, testing all over the place. And, you know, each doctor, because it was rare, never thought that, you know, the symptoms were interconnected, but they were. But when I was on Medicaid, everything was completely covered. If I had been on an insurance I had when I just got out of college, I think all but $750 for the year would have been covered. So both of those were pretty good. Now, I was still living in a different part of the state at some points, but say if these tests had to be done when I was on the insurance that I had about 12 or 13 years ago, I couldn't have afforded it because it covered very little. And, you know, it was just would have been something I couldn't afford test after test after test. You know, there was one, I think, that I talked to insurance about, and it was pretty much like, well, this test does not come back positive. We're not going to approve anymore. And, you know, that just kind of made me feel like, okay, I guess then finding the answer doesn't matter. That's what it makes a patient feel like. But, you know, again, I can understand both sides of these because I've experienced both sides. Okay, so we looked at reasons or the perceptions that some patients have and the reason why they have those perceptions. So the impact that this has overall to the access of healthcare, you know, can vary depending on patient. For one thing, you may have patients who have all of the things they need for proper healthcare. They have either great insurance that covers everything or money is not an option even beyond what insurance may cover. They may not have time constraints. You know, let's just say they work from home or make their own schedule as compared to those who work a, you know, regimented shift. They might be close to, you know, the doctors they need to go to. And, you know, depending on whether or not there's a major or not major health condition, that will also impact their access to health care. So do they need to travel long distances or no? You know, with private insurance, what are your deductibles? So there's a whole host of factors into that. But, you know, we're seeing overall that the cost of health care has been increasing. And so the idea of those who have everything that they need to access terrific health care is, it's kind of dwindling. There aren't that many people who can sit there and say, there is absolutely no hurdle for me to get the best healthcare possible. And then as you get into specifics of each patient and each condition, all of these other factors start to come into play. Even if you have two patients with the same approximate income, the same type of insurance, the difference could be that one patient, you know, lives in an area where there's not a lot of doctors that treat that illness as compared to the other one, or one may not be able to get off of work and the other one can. So even if we have the same baseline for the insurance, there are other factors that limit the access to healthcare. And where this really put patients was they needed to work to pay for their insurance and pay for their health care. However, they couldn't get off work to get the necessary testing or go to the appointments that they needed to. Or, as we see all the time, that medications could run so high that they couldn't afford the actual cost. Okay, last time I had one of my infusions done, the bill that was actually presented was for over $14,000, and I have that done around six times a year. So needless to say, if I did not have insurance, there would be no way possible that I would be able to pay that. It would just be beyond the realm of even a possibility. And by the way, this was for the generic form. For biologics, it's not called generic, it's called biosimilar. But this was for the biosimilar version. So it's just shocking to see the amount submitted to a doctor for that. Now, of course, with insurance, there are certain rates they negotiate, so they probably would never get the whole $14,000. But at the beginning of each year, as my coinsurance and deductibles reset, I get really, really worried because I don't know how I'm going to be able to pay these things as they're, you know, coming up. So what this can actually do is make a person's condition worse. If someone's presented with the fact that they may get a very large bill or that they may miss time from work and either, you know, not get paid for that, or possibly even if they have to miss too much time, have to, you know, quit work, that's going to be in the front of their mind that they need income coming in. and they need for the bills not to be so high, so they delay actually going to the doctor. And what this does is, if it's an illness that's more easily treated at the beginning rather than at the end, which most are, then, you know, the person is kind of in a bind, and by the time they get to the point that they go to the hospital or they go to their primary care doctor, then, you know, they'll probably end up having the same issues come up, except for a longer period of time. So they may need to miss more work. You know, the testing may be more extensive. So with these sometimes unintentional biases and the inequities within the healthcare system, it can actually make people and their conditions worse. You know, the saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. What that really means, and I admit it took me forever to figure out what that meant growing up, but if you can do something that's preventative from either getting an illness, or, you know, at the very beginning, preventing the worst symptoms from occurring, that is 1,000 times better than, you know, afterwards having to go take medication or have a procedure that's going to cost you a lot more, medicine that will cost you a lot more to treat this. Then within all of this, you may have some healthcare providers that don't accept certain types of insurance. And primarily where we see this is usually with Medicare and Medicaid, but it's even a possibility with other insurances that they may not accept. And my first question would be, well, why wouldn't you accept an insurance? And it comes down to reimbursement rates. You know how I mentioned earlier that the bill presented for my treatment was $14,000? When the bill would be presented to the insurance company, it would show the $14,000, but there would be what they accept on behalf of my insurance. So with my particular one, it was broken down so oddly or strangely because I had coinsurance, and then it, you know, I ended the coinsurance because I met the maximum. But the doctor and the insurance companies all come together and they come up with a figure that they will accept, meaning, okay, it's this amount, but per our agreement, we'll accept 70% or something like that. So, you know, there's negotiated amounts for each insurance. So that means two patients can come in with different insurances, and the amount that the doctor accepts for the same visit or same procedure may be different based on the insurance that they have. So doctors, if they look at the actual costs, may say, you know what, there's not a lot of reimbursement from this particular insurance, and to, you know, have appointments or treatments where we're only going to be getting this amount, you know, it doesn't cover the expenses that we need that to cover. So, you know, or any variety of that is just not high enough. So that's why doctors will not accept all insurances. And again, mostly Medicaid and Medicare, but it can be others too. I even had a case of one of my doctors. He was an OBGYN, but now he's just the GYN. He did not accept, you know, patients who were having a baby. He used to, and he actually delivered, I can't remember if it was, I think it was quads, not quints, but, you know, a very high risk pregnancy, and he was stellar at his profession. Everybody loved him, but he did not accept he did accept my insurance for regular visits, but he would not accept me as a patient when I was pregnant because he stopped delivering babies. And the reason being, not even to do with insurance, it was the fact that malpractice insurance was so high for OBs that he just decided the cost of doing business with that was not worth it. And, you know, again, he had a stellar reputation, so I don't know if he was ever actually sued or anything, but whatever it was, the amount of the one type of insurance just made him say, I'm not doing this anymore. Then I had to go to a different doctor who did accept, you know, of course, people who were expecting, but out of all the other OBGYNs around, he was the only one who accepted the insurance. And it was not pleasant. He was very judgmental. It was, the care was done more as a business transaction and not a patient transaction. And as far as the judgmental part, you know, he came in to check on me after I had my second child, and there had been nothing on the TV. Like there was nothing interesting. So I was watching an old Top Chef rerun, and he comes in and looks at the TV and told me that I needed to stop watching that because that would make me eat too much and I needed to lose weight. So not in a constructive manner, not, you know, now that you've had your baby, you may want to consider speaking with a dietitian or anything like that. It was just, you know, basically you're watching this and this will make you eat. So, unfortunately then sometimes if you have to go to certain doctors, they are definitely not the right one, but you are stuck with what doctor accepts your insurance. So, you know, he didn't look at my individual circumstances. He didn't look at the fact that a good portion of my weight was coming from my lymphedema. You know, it's just amazing sometimes, but this is where I'm going to end it today because I actually intended to get much farther than this, but you know, we're about 45 minutes in, so I'm going to go ahead and end here and start next week on the patient-provider interaction, which, you know, I've kind of been talking about, you know, anyway, but this will just have a few more in-depth examples, things like that. So I will try to get this next episode out earlier rather than how this was running late. Because, you know, I've already done all the research, already looked at, you know, the main study, as well as I'm backing that up through a couple other articles that I read. So, you know, they all seem to say the same thing. And honestly, a lot of it to me is because of my experiences, I can see the perspectives. So, you know, I may just go ahead and, you know, get the second one done pretty quickly. I appreciate everybody hanging in there. And again, I am looking at changing the hosting site. And what the hosting site is they're the ones that support the podcast as far as all the electronics and stuff and technical things. So if that changes, they should be able to redirect the podcast, meaning it should be able to come directly onto the new site without, you know, making any changes. You should be able just to go in and look through Google or wherever you look and it'll be there. So I hope everybody has a great week. All my contact information and sources are in the description below. So I'll talk to you soon. Bye.